Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. It is Wednesday, special Wednesday edition, August 26th. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined by Tim Priester and Drew Mentock of Irish Illustrated and John Bryce of USA Today. JB, we're going to get to the first $50 million rosters soon in segment one, but I think we'll start first. Had our last practice access yesterday, guys, about 20 minutes. And I think the notable issue, Drew, of course, no Quincy Porter after a procedure. Javion Osborne watching, but in pads. And as you pointed out, Sullivan Abshire in elbow brace.
Yes, yeah. And he was still out there with the first team in drills doing stuff. And I watched him specifically use his arm and elbow and extend it and block with it. So it could just be something that's an extra precaution. He's still clearly using it, but obviously he's the guy, as you know, the transcripts and stuff I've read over from Denbrock too have shown that, like, that spot is still up for grabs. So I don't know, maybe that injury has come into play. I believe it was a back injury in the past that he was dealing with. So this is something new as well. Again, we don't have any of the specifics on it, but he's definitely hampered by something, and that spot isn't locked down. And as we've talked about yesterday too, Scott Stiles Prescott is sounds like he's in the mix now for that competition too, as well as Ashton Craig potentially working at multiple spots. So it's definitely still a question mark, you know, less than 2 weeks out from the game. But, and you mentioned Porter, I did see him on an exercise bike, which if we're looking for a little bit of good news, having him after a knee procedure be able to kind of bend and ride a bike is a good sign that maybe he could be up to doing physical activity sooner than later. But obviously that injury has been kept him off the field for longer than I think anyone around the program would have liked.
Tim Priester, I think we're just going to grab one of the questions from segment one right now, because it's totally relevant to how we started this thing. And I'm going to ask you this from Canadian Invasion. First, it was Matty Augustine. Then Ashton Craig out of position. Now Stiles Prescott from left tackle to right guard. Is this coaching staff looking for reasons not to start Sullivan Abshire?
I think that's a fair question. I think it's also fair to indicate what Drew just did. He had a brace on his left arm, elbow, and so there's something there. But I'm not even sure. I'm not even sure Denbrock mentioned Abshire's name when talking about the offensive line yesterday. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a fair question, and probably the answer is yes. I think Matty Augustine would be in that starting spot at this point, or real close to being elevated to that starting spot at this point. You know, look, there are a lot of teams in the country with offensive line issues, Wisconsin being one of them. I'm sure they would love to have Sullivan Abshire to insert into their starting lineup. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a fair question, and I think it's mostly accurate.
I think also that it's Notre Dame recognizing that it's very likely to need seven or eight offensive linemen over the balance of this season, particularly when you still don't have a real clear grasp on the timeline of a Charles Jagasa, especially when you very openly, even if you talk about the process and week by week, but very, very obviously and somewhat openly expect to play a 15, 16 game season. Like, I think you've got to build that depth now while you can before the season gets started, because it's harder and harder to divide those reps. So I do think it's learning from the recent years of needing to be proactive. And yeah, I think Sullivan Abshire had left the door cracked, but also I think a lot of that was Matty Augustine kicking in the door as much as it was Sullivan Abshire leaving the door cracked, based on the people I talked to on campus. But Sullivan's got to get fully healthy, and he has to play better to command that job and not be looking over his shoulder while he has that job.
With Prescott too, I think something Denbrock pointed out is that they did see some natural tendencies there. Obviously he's been at tackle most of the time, but maybe guard does fit better with him. And yeah, it just could come down to something interesting. If one of the tackles does go down and Prescott is maybe better suited for guard, maybe he's at guard and now Anthony Knapp is kicked back out to tackle or something like that. So there's definitely some shuffling and figuring out what's going to happen. To your point, JB, if an injury does happen, like, there might be more movement than they would like at this point.
Or as Tim and I talked about instant analysis yesterday, I mean, maybe it's outing at center and Ashton Craig at guard. Now Ashton Craig is not completely full go, or they're not letting him participate full go. Let's put it that way. I don't know that he's had any physical setbacks, but you know, Denbrock said he's not 100%. He didn't use that 100% term, but that's essentially what he was saying. So there are some options there. You know, this is for 8 months, we've been talking about what a great football team this is. And it is a great football team, but you never have a pat hand at every position all the time. And right now you've got a little bit of a hiccup on the offensive line. Prescott, maybe he is a better guard than tackle. Although I think it sounds like he did start to make his move at tackle. Then they put him inside and they liked what they saw there. So there's still some options there. And it's, you know, you look at the first six games of the season and you feel like you've got a little bit of leeway and then maybe you don't have to be perfect on the offensive line to be 6-0 heading to BYU.
I think there's one more injury and you could start worrying a little bit. Because you'd be down three of your eight best players, and in reality, you're down three of your six best linemen, maybe. If you think Abshire and Ottinger are 7-8, you might be with Augustine, Jogesta, and Craig. You might be down three of your six best linemen. So it's worse than it was. This is the exact quote from Denbrock. It's been nice to have Ashton back for team periods and stuff like that. He is still, I think he would tell you, close, but not there yet. We're hoping as the week ends, we get some advice from doctors exactly where he is. That will determine more. He's a difference maker at center, and even when we played him at guard, he's done a nice job there. So there's definitely a doctor involved here in trying to get him back on the field, and that's relevant with the game coming up, I think. No doctor involved, but a transfer portal was. John Bryce, they got Armel Mukum back out of the transfer portal. I don't know if you saw this, but Chris Ash said, yeah, he must matter. We fought like hell to get him back.
Yeah, I did see that. That was a very interesting situation as it unfolded back in January. And it's my understanding that Mukum had some six-figure offers once he entered the portal, but then talked it over and talked with his mom specifically, I was told, went back and met with Marcus Freeman, and they said, yeah, we'll open the door to have you back. Here are some stipulations. Obviously, around that same time, Notre Dame was working to secure, I don't remember the exact timing, but Notre Dame was working on Brew and Teon Gray, but you need depth in there. You need stature in there. Mukum had shown some flashes, and you invest in a guy for two full years the way Notre Dame had, you want to have a chance to get an ROI with that in a third year.
Yeah, and, you know, Chris Ash said that Tim, you mentioned this on Instant Analysis, they liked the what Mukum was doing last year, and he complimented him on his work ethic and, you know, working hard and staying at it. But they liked, you know, they had Donovan Heinisch. They had Jared Dawson. Jason Onyia was emerging. So there were other people that they liked there better. But, you know, these kind of stories, like Ash made a point of saying, you know, a lot of times people say, you know, if he hasn't arrived by now, he won't arrive. Well, that's not true. Well, most of the time it is true. But it wasn't in the case of Armel Mukum. So to Notre Dame's advantage, Drew, looking forward to actually seeing your story on him. I even haven't had a chance to read exactly what he said, but it's potentially a really great story. Will he start? Probably not. I would think, you know, Onyia started 9 games last year. You know, and I think Brew is probably the other starter there, and you have Teon Gray, and you got a bunch of different combinations. But Armel Mukum's in the mix. It's a great story.
And I think with Mukum, too, it's worth noting he went into the portal not knowing if he could come back to Notre Dame either. And it definitely sounds a little bit like without Partridge coming that this wasn't going to be an option. He heard about the hire. He looked him up. He realized like this guy was legit. And he talked a lot about yesterday, too, about just some of like the immediate changes that Partridge pointed out in his game. Like he said he was false stepping. Like if he was supposed to step first with his right, he would take a quick one with his left before he like got off the line. It's just like little things like that that you feel like really have opened the door for his game. So it sounds like that. I mean, getting, you know, finishing up at Notre Dame, all that stuff too. But knowing Partridge was the guy you could come back to, he talked to him while he's in the portal. And I think that was a really big selling point. And it has probably worked out how he thought, where he's going to get maybe the development he wanted by staying at Notre Dame.
I will just add very quickly, if I may, I talked to someone at Pitt and someone in the NFL, and both coaches told me Partridge was the best they'd ever been around in that position. So I did want to provide that insight. And I've alluded to that earlier, but I talked to both of those guys again over the course of the summer about a number of topics. And they were just like, Notre Dame got a good one. Like, he's as good as I've been around. And when an NFL guy says that, especially, I think that's pretty resonant.
We have a question on running backs, so we'll go to everybody's favorite topic outside of the offensive line, and probably including the offensive line, wide receivers, asking Mike Denbrock. You know, we know your four, including Gilbert And Mike Denbrock kind of interrupted and said, well, you better include the lacrosse player fifth, Matt Jeffrey. So I think you can look at Jeffrey as a backup field to Faison. And there's then Elijah Burris. They have moved into boundary, and they moved into boundary before camp began. It's not like it's a random camp experiment. It'd be interesting to see if Elijah Boundary could win that backup role on the boundary for Micah Gilbert, because if you're going to sub one guy out more than the others, I would assume it's Micah Gilbert, not the Faison Graham Great House trio.
That's an unusual fit. Mm-hmm. Burris moving to the boundary. I mean, I hope it works. And he, you know, Ash even indicated, you know, or Denbrock even indicated what, you know, what it takes, the physicality of playing that boundary position. So it's encouraging. It's nice to have, and we've seen Elijah Burris make some plays. We know that he's, you know, he has the ability to be electric as a wide receiver, just not a perfect fit. So we'll see how that works out.
And then finally, Bubba Frazier is kind of like the, we use the phrase call up too much. He's the X factor, I guess. You could get Bubba Frazier in there if Mike Denbrock wants to, but he kind of admitted, and I think we said this on Instant Analysis, but we'll say it for the Irish Illustrated Insider listeners. He might be electric in space, but he'll sometimes drop the ball in space too. And that is something that you want to work around if you have six receivers that will catch the ball and make plays for you. But I'd love to see Bubba Frazier kind of work his way into it. As Tim has said many times, he doesn't have to work his way into it at Lambeau Field.
Yeah, and also, like, again, as we've discussed multiple times, 5-for-5 is here. It's in the court systems, but it's also here for all these players who are actual college student athletes right now, and there's no holding back. So a guy like Bubba Frazier, as we've alluded to, or Iwatade or Dunham or Joey O'Brien, Kyrie Adams, these are guys who are going to carve roles over the course of the season, and just because you don't see them in week one or don't see them on the last Saturday of September doesn't mean you're not going to see them over the balance of October, November, and December. And that's the way it's been put to me, is that there will be a core of this really highly regarded freshman class that carve niche roles, and the coaches feel empowered to do that now because of 5-for-5.
Yeah, and I think with Frazier, you could see, I mean, even if it's just a few snaps a game, I mean, think back to even Jordan Faison as a freshman. Obviously, they're in more dire need of receivers who could play when he went against Louisville, but it was like he understood how to run two routes, and they had a good look for one of them, and it turned into a touchdown. And I could see kind of a, you know, less desperate, but get him on for a few favorable snaps to even early on, just to take advantage of his explosiveness and see if you can get him in a good position.
And maybe, you know, if you trust him to protect the football, maybe the easiest place to launch Frazier is as the kick returner. I know we have a question in segment two about kick returners. We'll get into that more, but you know, I mean, everybody has that we've talked to about Bubba Frazier has commented about his great speed. It's perfect for that. Not very big. Can he protect the football? You know, he can take some big shots on kick returns, but I would think he would be a candidate for that. We'll get into more candidates in segment two.
Wrapping up the coordinators yesterday, I talked to, between Kyle Kelly of Blue and Gold and I, if we peppered Chris Ash with enough defensive line questions, you thought Charlie Partridge was out there. But I asked Ash, because he brought left and right to Notre Dame's defensive end rotation instead of boundary and field. I have a story going up on that on IrishIllustrated.com. Kyle Kelly asked a little bit about Dunham and Iwatade, and then he went back and asked a little bit about Dunham and Iwatade, and it is pretty clear they are not in the top four. The left and right does not include the two freshmen. Logan Thomas is there because he said in no uncertain terms, when they have to get to a point where they can help us, and when they get to that point,
yeah,
their hard work will be rewarded.
I wouldn't think that that's etched in stone, and I'm sure you don't either. You know, Keon Keeley's rise, and now we've had a defensive line coach and the defensive coordinator talk about the rise of Keon Keeley, and so that's impressive. Before we get out of this segment, I do want to talk about Kedron Young, because that's a guy that I've said, look, until something happens, until there's a buzz, we're not going to be saying Kedron Young's about ready to step forward. I think we can do that now.
Yeah, he mentioned that Kedron Young had a great week, and I said that was relevant because sometimes people say, oh, he's had a great camp. Well, he said what we've been looking for was physicality from him, and we finally got it. It illustrates what we've been saying all along. Looking big doesn't make you a physical runner. For 1 week in a scrimmage, he's been a physical runner, and that is much more important than someone saying, oh, yeah, he's had a great summer, he's had a great camp.
Yeah,
no, yeah, I mean, would you rather have Audric Estime or Kyron Williams in a short yarded situation? I think you'd probably, I mean, obviously you look at the success, but even back then you would have gone with Kyron, who's significantly smaller, but he knew how to get low.
Yeah. They want Jabron Payne over Audric Estime in that situation.
I know I'm jumping around here on you, Tim, by going to Kedron Young, but I'm going to jump back to defensive ends.
A couple questions.
I think Rodney Dunham's going to make it. He's still going to make it very difficult to keep him off the field this year.
Oh, this year. Yeah. What Ash was talking about the whole situation there, I think Logan Thomas is trusted to run the right side of that right now. And of course there's packages, and we also see all three of those guys running down on kickoffs. That's how athletic they are. Logan Thomas, Ebenezer Uwatahe, and Rodney Dunham are running down covering kickoffs for Notre Dame. John Bryce, saw your story on USA Today. Very well done about the first $50 million roster is here. It's not alone. There's a lot of high $40 million rosters as well. Want to delve into that a little bit. I think people over the last week have realized, people I think knew who the big spenders were last year. It was because everybody talked about Texas Tech, quote unquote, buying a playoff spot. They also failed to buy a single point in that playoff, but they are, again, one of the big spenders in college football.
They are. I don't think they're the most, as much because of Brendan Sorsby's situation as anything, based on the people we talked to and quite literally started this project in May. I spoke with close to 25 FBS head coaches, about 15 at the power conference levels as well. Spoke with at least 25 college football general managers and directors of player personnel, and then another dozen or plus agents in that market space to get an idea of where things are going. Pretty unanimous. Miami was considered the most expensive roster in college football for the 2026 season in that $54, $55 million range. Their LSU, we've been told, is in that $51 million range. Texas A&M around $45 million. Texas, Ohio State, both up there in that $50 million range. Notre Dame somewhere between 40 and 50, depending on who you talk to. But Notre Dame has a bunch of seven-figure players. That's just the bottom line. So there's a lot of money there. There's homegrown seven-figure players, and there's portal-acquired seven-figure players, and that runs your tab up in a hurry. And that's the thing I thought most striking, is that how open people were when they were talking about it. When I have a power conference GM, two different ones, saying, like, well, we're at $35 million. We can compete there. Like, we're not the most by far. We're not the most in our conference by far, but we can compete. And I had a guy with a $40 million roster say, okay, we're $14 million behind the team we're going to have to beat at some point this season. That's pretty striking. And then Rich Rodriguez, who I quoted in the story, telling me directly on the record, too many Saturdays in college football right now. We're lined up to have a $40 million roster against a $15 million roster. To which I followed up and said, well, how often do you think that's happening? And he said, probably about 50% of the time in Power Four games. He felt, not necessarily that the discrepancy was $25 million, but he felt very strongly that there's a massive spend discrepancy at least 50% of the time in intra-conference games. And as you look at this, an SEC GM told me in that story, and I quoted, that their payroll last year was around $26 million, and they were the upper third in the SEC last year. And now $26 million would put you in the bottom third of the SEC just year over year. And another GM telling me, like, $60 million is where it will be next year. And he was and he point blank said, F, we're trying to get to 50, and that's really hard, but somebody will get to $60 million next year, or somebody's will get to $60 million. And he said, that's about the end. That has to be the end of it, or the money runs dry, the system blows up, and without reform, you're talking about somebody will spend $100 million in 3 years if there's meaningful change not enacted.
So you're saying the idea of scoffing at Notre Dame spending acquisition fees on people might be gone in terms of keeping up with college football. It was 3 years ago that there's like, well, they're not going to pay for players. I think they might.
since you're kind enough to bring up our work, and I've alluded to this, it should be publishing next week. My nightmares from the transfer portal story may be the best thing I do all college football season. And it's phenomenal, from one recruitment coming down to a Rolex to another recruitment.
Can you imagine nowadays coming down to a Rolex? What is your, I mean, how about just get a couple more later? What in the world?
No. It was the money was insane. This is a recruitment in the last 2 years. The money was insane, but the money was the same from three different major programs. And the one that procured him the Rolex got him to sign. It was that simple. Another one from this past portal gave a list of demands that had to be met, including like a $250,000 signing bonus. And the guy ended up never even going into the portal, but he was being shopped around. It's mind-boggling. And again, finally, probably my favorite one, and I might have alluded to it if I'm repeating myself. I guess it means I'm old or I've talked to O'Malley too much, but a head coach told me he exited the stage from his introductory press conference within the past 2 years and walked to his office and had a guy sitting outside of his office waiting to negotiate a new deal, literally as he walked from his introductory press conference.
Yeah.
A power conference head coach, mind you.
As I like to point out, people that complain about, you know, if a basketball coach or anyone complains about his roster, imagine having 105 parents, sets of parents calling you and complaining, and 105 agents now, and say, what's fun about college football? Not that. That's the hardest thing right there. What is fun about college football? Oh, sorry, JB, go ahead.
I was just going to say, actually, though, tying it into college athletics in general, it was interesting because I spoke with a stakeholder who works with maybe 55 major college programs last week, and he said, like, you can still pretty easily justify where the money is in football. He was like, look, it needs reform, like, because of what it's going to kill otherwise. He said, but you can justify based off the revenue and the strict finances where the numbers are in football right now. He said, I don't care if you're Duke or Kentucky, you cannot justify a $20 to $24 million college basketball roster when your net revenue is only ever $15 million, $16 million at the most. And then, yeah, you're on TV in March Madness. He said the math does not work. So I thought that was very interesting that for as much as we talk about the higher volume of spending in college football, it's college basketball that's being perceived, at least out of this most recent cycle into the coming year, as being the one that's most askew.
The math will work great in segment two, because we're going to talk about our tour of Shields Family Hall. And there's a little math that went into that one. Also a little bit of money. We'll be back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards. We are back with segment two. We call it Burning Up the Boards. Our first question comes from Eric Simeon, probably not the ex-linebacker. But anyway, the Loftus Center opened in 1988, Shields Family Hall in 2026. Coincidence? I think not. That's actually a statement, Tim Priester, but I'm going to turn it over to you because you wrote a story on Shields Family Hall.
Yeah, I did. I didn't go back to Loftus, but you know, Notre Dame's in a situation now where the renovation, the Campus Crossroads project, the renovation of the stadium in 2017, the Irish Athletics Center in 2020, and now this. You know, for those of us that have spent their lives in South Bend, it's no surprise to us that Notre Dame's been chasing facilities against the big boys our entire lives, and they're not doing that now. Ron Paulus, who led us through the facility yesterday, was asked to, you know, is there anything on your list, you know, to upgrade in 5 years? And that was a little that was a little much for Paulus at this point, because that facility is quite spectacular. But yeah, you know, I mean, I don't know that words can accurately describe it. We'll have pictures with the story coming up here shortly, but they have everything they need. They don't have water slides. They don't have bowling alleys. They don't have stuff like that. But, you know, it's how can you not be impressed? And, the players, they have everything they need. And they're cultivating an environment where everything that the players need to be in that building, whether it's athletic or academic, social or otherwise. So it's all in there, and the pictures probably obviously don't do it justice, but it was pretty cool being in a position of having the opportunity to walk through the facility.
Yeah, it was fun walking through, and I feel like Isaiah Dunn got the same comment from everyone. He's the former walk-on who's now with WNDU as a reporter, and everyone was just like, is this really hard for you to see what they get 5 months after you leave the program? And I think he got that question twenty times, but it was.
I told him he was born a year too early.
Yes, yeah,
you just missed it, dude.
You could tell he walked through saw the massage chairs and the hydro chambers and all that stuff, and you could tell he was like, man, what did I miss out on? But you could tell everything was built so intentionally too. And Ron Paulus talked about getting the different experts, whether that's like Alexa Appleman looking at training tables, and they have a fueling station right outside the locker room. And Bryce has talked about on this podcast with Lauren Lando and the input he had in the weight room. And we got to see the speed track and, you know, how that's specific for speed, and how they have TVs above the weight rack so they can look across and see what their lifts are supposed to be. Like, everything they just put very intentionally, and they tried not to waste space or have something just there for show. Even the recruiting center, they're like, well, maybe we can find out a way to do walkthroughs here and stuff like that too. So everything just very intentional. And even though they put in a lot of money, maybe more than they thought they would have at first, like it sounds like it was very well planned and not just throwing stuff out there to spend to spend.
Well, and as we've discussed on the pod before as well, Palace and company were touring other facilities around the country years ago, at least as far back as 2023, maybe as far back as 2022. But I know for sure 2023 because some Notre Dame officials flew down to Clemson early in order to tour the Tigers facility before that debacle of a game in Death Valley in 2023. So a lot of intentionality gone into this and a lot of user-friendly attributes for the players, as we discussed last week or the week before, in terms of how they can access the rehab and the player recovery areas 24 hours a day, and they'll have their personalized lockers. And you all noted before we went on air the laundry chutes. So, yeah, it's just very efficient, very user-friendly, and a great hub for all things Notre Dame football.
My two cents is it still smelled great. New car smell was still there. Next question, Memphis Phil. We were blessed to have Jadarian Price returning kicks these past few seasons. Any front runners for the new kick returner?
Well, I mentioned Bubba Frazier. I don't know if he's necessarily a front runner. He certainly has the skill set to do it. You know, you could put Jordan Faison back there, but do you really want to risk your top receiver while he's already receiving punts and is on special teams? You have to be careful there.
Never seen him back there for in the practices we've had.
I've seen him back there. I don't know that I've actually seen him take.
I've seen him
with the group. That's all I would say. But I'm gonna like this is kind of a guess right now because I mean we're guessing on all of these. I'm gonna say Nolan James. I think it's a chance to get Nolan James involved now that Kedron Young has taken a step forward. And they like Jonas Walton. Maybe that will be a responsibility they would give to Nolan James. I don't have any intel on that right now, but the names that we've mentioned here, Dallas Golden has been back there. I don't think they want to use him because of some of the recent physical ailments that he's had. Maybe Nolan James, maybe that's a good fit for him.
I think James will be the role that Aeneas Williams was in last year, the blocking kick returner.
I was going to say, based on the people I've talked to and obviously subject to change, but I would be surprised if at least early on next month that it's not Aeneas Williams and Nolan James back there. And then it could evolve from there and likely will evolve over the balance of the season for reasons we've already outlined. But I think early on it's trending toward Aeneas Williams and Nolan James based on the folks I've talked to.
You guys know what Aeneas Williams said last year when we asked him about blocking on kick return? It was when he was talking openly about, you know, frustrations and going into game five as a kick returner and then not playing at all from scrimmage. And that ruined his, what doesn't matter at all anymore, 5-for-5. But he said, well, the teams have been lucky not to kick to me because it would be different.
I love his delivery because when he says that, it's not like, you know, we always talk about the difference between cocky and confidence. Yeah. It's confidence, man. It's like he's not boasting. He's just telling you the way he feels.
And to say it like that, too, after you weren't really playing that year, too. Like, it didn't seem to sway his confidence.
All right. Question number 3, Irish from A2. Last year, everyone was blindsided by the poor performance of the defense for the first 10 quarters of the season. If something similar happens in 2026, what position group could you see this coming from? Tim O'Malley, we'll go to you first because question 6, I'm going to go to Priester first.
For a blindside, I would be they don't run the ball well. I mean, a blindside would be if they don't protect CJ Carr. But a blindside for me would be if they don't run the ball well in the first month because of the offensive line. The offensive line inefficiencies, not knowing who they want there, and the missing parts. A total blindside would be if they don't protect CJ Carr, because CJ Carr is part of that, and he will make sure he is protected with his pre-snap situation. But offensive line is my position group this year that would be a massive surprise.
Group?
Yeah, I agree. It would have to be the run game, especially looking – I mean, last year they started with Miami A&M. At least Wisconsin has good linebackers that if they're not protecting right or the run game's a little off, like – that is a team that at least could be disruptive there and maybe they would have some struggles. But a lot of that did. I mean, I know two of those quarters were against Purdue, but it didn't help the competition they were playing when they were also off their game and confused.
Yeah. Like you guys, like I don't expect well, I'm going to speak for myself. I don't expect the defense to start like that again. So I'm looking on the offensive side of the ball. And Tim, the blind side is exactly it. We haven't heard that there are any issues with Will Black or Gerby Lambert. In fact, man, I think that has the potential to be a great 1-2 punch at offensive tackle. But you concern yourself with stuff like that, especially with CJ Carr and knowing the backup situation behind him.
Yeah, might as well make us the four horsemen because yeah. I'm going to agree. Because wide receiver struggles wouldn't surprise us. And so you can't consider if the wide receivers struggle or have some issues. We wouldn't be blindsided by that. But I think it's time for this. We've heard so much about the Notre Dame offensive line for so long. It's time for this group to open the season being dominant, knowing that they will get better as they continue to coalesce in game and play side by side and get actual experience in the case of Will Black. And I'm like you, TP. I think they feel really, really good about Will Black, Anthony Knapp, and Gerby Lambert. I think the concern rests at center and right guard for health and consistency reasons. I think that's it. So I'm going absolutely with the O-line. Would be blindsided because I've heard nothing but good things about Porath and Jasper and what they've done on special teams. They think that's back to being a weapon in all phases. So, yeah, there you go.
Question number four from ND1012. What will happen first in the season? Aeneas Williams runs for a 40-yard touchdown, or Jaden Greathouse catches a 40-yard touchdown pass?
Go ahead, Drew.
I think this is a really good question. They both have 3 runs or catches of 40-plus yards in their career. Obviously, Greathouse, one of them, as Bryce pointed out before the podcast, was that 54-yarder against Penn State. So neither of them are considered burners, but they're both shown they can make big plays. I think I would go with Aeneas Williams just because we saw him do it more recently. I think he does know how to hit that hole and shown he can break away. Now it was against Stanford and Navy last year, but still he's shown that more recently. Whereas, I mean, Greathouse can do it, but I think he's going to maybe get fewer opportunities, whereas Aeneas Williams is going to be that number one option at running back.
I'm going to go with Greathouse and partly because of some intel I picked up yesterday from campus, and that's just the camp that Greathouse has had, the stride that he is hitting. It's, according to people in the program, looking like the guy who was so effective in that playoff run, but also better body, more mature, more dynamic. Really, really encouraged by what I've heard throughout camp on Jaden Greathouse from a mentality approach, from a production approach, and especially what I heard yesterday. So I forget the exact term, but it was very, very strong endorsement of Jaden Greathouse. So because of that, and because of the fact that he only has to do half the work in that equation because he's catching a ball from the great CJ Carr. So I'll take Jaden Greathouse.
Yeah. There's a reason I put Jaden Greathouse as the number 2 receiver last week on our podcast question ahead of Mylon Graham, because I've heard Greathouse has been fantastic. I'm going Greathouse also. Same reason CJ Carr throws it to him, but even more important, let's go matchup. Wisconsin's got a good rush defense. 41 yards away, CJ Carr hits Jaden Greathouse, so this thing's over. Tim Priester, this question was a homage to the Logan Diggs and Deion Colsey question of 2021. Or 2022. What happens?
Wow. Yeah.
Diggs gets 100 yards or Colsey gets a touchdown. It should happen this time, though, unlike those.
Well, I don't think either happens necessarily in the Wisconsin game. And look, Greathouse is, I mean, it's wonderful to be able to look out there, and he looks great. He looks confident. You know, he carries himself like an established football player, which is probably how he thinks of himself. But he ran into some adversity last year and didn't get an opportunity to build upon how he ended the 2024 season. So very, very encouraged by that. Having said that, I'm going to agree with Drew on this. I think I see Aeneas Williams being the first to score that 40-yarder on the ground.
Our next question comes from Tally Alley. In a neutral site college football playoff game, what current top 10 AP team matches up well against Notre Dame? And name one that does not match up well versus Notre Dame. I'm sure people will like that answer more.
JB, why don't you jump in there?
All right. I think for the top 10 that would match up very well with Notre Dame, I would probably go first with Texas, especially if Goosby gets back healthy for them. That's a significant loss that we don't have a great deal of clarity of right now on the Texas offensive line, although the indications are he will definitely be back sooner rather than later. And Trevor Goosby is one of the top offensive linemen anywhere in the country. But what they've invested, they've got a guy like Cam Coleman that they would feel very confident matching up with Leonard Moore, and that would be a matchup of two future first-round draft picks. They've got a veteran quarterback in Arch Manning. They've got that big offensive line. They've got some really dynamic defenders, especially in their front seven. So I would go with Texas feeling like that they would match up incredibly well with Notre Dame. From the top 10, I think there's some highly overrated teams in the top 10, to be honest with you. So I'm gonna try to still go like top five. And I think Notre Dame would match up well with Oregon. Oregon has to replace a lot on its offensive line now. It's being touted as maybe having the best defensive line in the country, but a matchup like this wouldn't occur until later in the season when Notre Dame's offensive line presumably has gotten even stronger. And obviously, as we alluded to, Will Black's gotten real experience by that point in time. So, yeah, Texas matches up well right now, in my opinion, with Notre Dame. I don't think Oregon would match up quite as well because I'm not convinced that overall on both sides of the ball that Oregon team would be as physical as Notre Dame that I expect Notre Dame to be.
Well, if you're going to beat Notre Dame, you better have a great quarterback because you're throwing into a great back seven on defense. Who has the great quarterbacks? Oregon does with Dante Moore. Texas does with Arch Manning. Julian Sayin at Ohio State. And, of course, Miami quarterback transfer from Duke. So I think that's one prerequisite. Who can, and then on the flip side, who has some of the better secondaries in the country to deal with CJ Carr? Among the top ones are Oregon, Georgia, Miami. But, you know, I mean, I think you can go, like, I'm looking at it by position here, and it's the usual suspects, regardless what position that you go to. That's why those teams are in the top 10. But I would agree with JB as far as Oregon being one that you'd feel good about a Notre Dame matchup, just because we know Notre Dame's athleticism has improved greatly in recent years. And when Oregon hasn't been able to win these big games, a lot of times it's against somebody that's very physical. And we know that Notre Dame is very physical. I don't believe in Oklahoma. I love the matchup of head coaches between Notre Dame and Oklahoma. That would be another one that I would throw out, that I would like that matchup for Notre Dame. Not necessarily personnel wise, but Oklahoma didn't deserve to be in the playoffs last year, and Notre Dame did, and I would like to see Marcus Freeman matching up there.
I might eat my words, but real quickly, I'll just say Texas A&M, I know, is in the top 10. I think Texas A&M is significantly overrated. We'll see.
I was just going to say, I mean, Marcus Freeman has yet to prove he can beat Ohio State. They still have Jeremiah Smith, who's probably the one player who I would be worried, or, you know, could get the better of Leonard Moore on a consistent basis. I'm also, Oklahoma was the team I actually thought Notre Dame should have been most upset by being in the playoffs over them. I think their offense yards per play was like 97th or tied for 97th in the country last year. I don't think they've made significant improvements. I was going to go Texas as a good matchup for Notre Dame. Not everything point you made was good, JB, but I just think Notre Dame could get in their heads a little bit. I like the contrast of Marcus Freeman just saying we weren't good enough last year, where Steve Sarkisian is making excuses for missing the playoffs. I also like that CJ Carr went to the Manning Passing Academy, came out as like the clear, you know, guy at that camp. Arch Manning wasn't. We've seen him kind of not live up to expectations early last season. Maybe that would get in his head a little bit too. So I think just from a off the field mental matchup, I would like that for Notre Dame, even if Texas is probably one of the few teams, I think, to JB's point, might be more talented than Notre Dame.
I don't think the top 10 is so much different than the top 7 that you could name anybody. A&M, LSU, Ole Miss, none of those teams are as good as the top 7 this year. There's this dividing line, I think, right now going into the season. I think Notre Dame would match up well with Georgia because Gunnar Stockton does not present as many problems, and their talent drain at Georgia compared to what they used to have is just not what Georgia had. I'm not saying they're a top 7 team, but I think we are now nitpicking, and you have to play a top 7 team. So I'm taking Georgia for that one. I actually think, I mean, Ohio State's a great one because they could cause problems everywhere, but I actually think Notre Dame IU would be turned into a rock fight. I think IU's defense could handle Notre Dame's running game, and then it comes down to Notre Dame's wide receivers being better at the end of the year than they are now. And now IU's not scoring a lot of points on Notre Dame either. But rock fights get tough when you're in playoff games. I think that's one of along the lines of, let's see if someone else can take out IU instead, because he just turns into what could be a slog. That Notre Dame has won some slogs before, though. They're definitely comfortable in a lot of different styles. So I think that'd be a tough matchup for Notre Dame's running game. Our next question. Oh, sorry, JB, this is you. Like to step on your toes every once in a while. Keep you alert.
Worry hound. Question number 6 from T. McNear. Strength in numbers or an open competition? What does Marcus Freeman's comment about playing five running backs say about the room's true hierarchy? Tim Priester, the floor is yours.
Denbrock was really the one that ended up saying four or five could play last night in our interview with him. You know, I think you've got to get Jaywan Sider's opinion on that.
Yeah.
What does it say? I mean, clearly Aeneas Williams is number one. They have a true number one. I think they have five running backs that have a chance to all be good running backs on the collegiate level. Will it all happen this year? No. And playing four and five running backs. I mean, Dylan McCullough could say that, but number five wasn't really getting hugely significant snaps. So I think they're talented enough to that they can go four deep. We don't really know about JV and Osborne yet, other than Mike Denbrock said him and Jonas Walton were home run hitters. He also said they're a disaster in pass protection, which, I mean, it's so classic Denbrock. He's just not afraid to just speak his mind when something is not working. And, you know, it's not like he's saying it behind their back. He's up front with them about it on the practice field. But, you know, I think it is strength in numbers, and I think it is an open competition. They've been open-minded about it. I didn't necessarily think that Kedron Young was going to make progress on the depth chart heading into this with Jonas Walton emerging in the spring, but he has. So what it says is that Notre Dame's got a really good running backs room, and not all of them will be in a position to excel this year, but I would say all of them are capable of excelling if given the opportunity this year.
Yeah, I definitely took it partially too. I mean, Aeneas Williams is the guy. Then Kedron's also getting a little more ref because Nolan James has been banged up a little bit. And then we've heard a lot about Walton, and then there's five scholarship guys. So if you're going to talk about four, you may as well talk about all five too. I think not that Osborne isn't doing some stuff, but he's been hurt. Like, I think at some point it's also a little bit of coach speak, and that's a room. Wide receivers, you can't name all 15 or 16 there are now, but you can talk about all five running backs in a soundbite and not leave anybody out if you want to.
They definitely leave out some wide receivers when they start talking, I'll tell you that much, consistently too. Yeah, I think Marcus Freeman's a smart coach in the podium, and so he realized he should list all five running backs. That's why that happened. And Denbrock, his two most talented running backs are probably his guys that are going to play the least this year, Jonas Walton and Javion Osborne. That's just the way it is. But it is strength in numbers, but we wouldn't be talking about Notre Dame's fifth running back of Jadarian Price and Jeremiah Love here. So we always have to remember, when you're trying to find wide receiver 5, 6, 7, and 8, it's because you don't have wide receiver 1, 2, 3 as good as they could be in the past. If you had those two dudes, no one would be saying Nolan James's name.
No one said Nolan James's name last year. They wouldn't have
said it. That doesn't mean he's not going to be good. I just, you know, let's bring some reality to the equation too. Yeah. And the coaches are smart. Or Drew, you list four, you better list the fifth, or you're getting a phone call.
That's very true. Or a parent sitting on Mike Denbrock's outside his office when he shows up. Do I have this question, Tim, number 7?
I do, yes.
Okay, that's from Canadian Invasion. And the question is, last August I heard a bunch of about two back sets and then nothing. If you had to guess, what talking point is getting a lot of August airtime only to disappear once the season rolls around?
Two back was funny because that happens a lot. But Drift.
I was just going to say, this isn't quite in the same vein, but I mean, I watched the linebackers up close yesterday and watched KVA go through drills, and honestly, he just looks smoother and more athletic than everyone in to a degree already. And I just think, I mean, we're kind of already getting there, but by the time we're mid-September, we're going to forget that he's 10 months removed from an ACL injury. Like, I just feel like the progress we've seen, everything we've heard, all that stuff, like, we're just not going to remember that weren't sure he was going to play and be ready at the start of the year. And I think he's just going to, maybe he'll still be a little limited because that room is so deep. They don't need to lean on him so much and the schedule's not bad, but yeah, he's just going to be the dude we thought he would be earlier than we thought.
Yeah, I think that's a great one, Drew. And I'll reiterate, you know, being in Nashville earlier this month at the National General Managers Recruiting and Personnel Symposium, talking with agents and NFL people there, KVA is very prominent in the minds of NFL people. And it's just a few months ago that Notre Dame thought he might have to be kind of a de facto October call-up. And now here he is, defying odds. He's supremely gifted. He's playing with a better mental command of everything, I've been told. So I think that's a great answer by you, Drew Mintonk.
I think people will stop caring about the backup wide receivers in about 2 weeks when the first four wide receivers do well. No one's going to be saying, why can't they get the seventh guy in? Who cares? Like, well, you play everybody. You don't, not everyone, it's not happy camp, and it's going to be scout team camp for five of the guys. So get used to it. They're highly paid to go on the scout team. I'm sick of it. Sick of wide receivers. This is a wide receiver free zone. I might not write about wide receivers the rest of the year. I can play 15 guys, for God's sakes.
The first thing that
angry O'Malley.
Come on.
See those, look at those clouds above his head. You see those clouds he's yelling at?
You know why he's not playing? He's not as good as the other guy.
Well, and that leading into following up this little tirade by Tim O'Malley, it's the Matt Jeffrey thing. If this coaching staff believes that CJ Carr can accentuate the skill set of Matt Jeffrey, who gives a damn what his background is?
Yeah, yeah.
If Quarter
comes back and Burris is better, Bettis is better, they should play Bettis.
Absolutely. If they deem Jeffrey better than those guys, then you've got to put him on field. It's like we talked about the other day. If a receiver runs a 16-yard route and it's supposed to be 18, that's an interception. And you're saying, why did the quarterback overshoot the receiver? Because the receiver ran the wrong route. But to answer the question, the first thing that came to mind for me was quarterback under center. I know we saw quarterback under center.
That's the winner.
briefly in a practice, and it was then turned into a story by the media, and I get that. But I'm not saying that they won't do that. I'm not saying they shouldn't do that. In fact, they probably should in short yardage situations. But to me, this is a camp thing that is going to run its course before the end of camp, and we're never going to address it again. I think it would be a good idea if they did, but it struck me as one of those kind of things fitting into the category of the question.
My next wide receiver story is going to be the six guys that aren't on varsity, just out of spite, so people can understand how unimportant it is that they don't all get to play football at the same time.
Look at you. You just said you weren't writing about them. Now you're all over the map. More
not
plans.
I'm not right. That's true. I need to write about them. It's going to happen anyway. I don't care. Spite's more important than my promise. Next question. Two-parter from Dollar Bills. Given the number of transfers on Notre Dame's team, which is fewer than their opponents, he had a long list, and it is fewer. What kind of advantage or disadvantage does this give Notre Dame this season? And in addition to that, Jay Harper, let's handle the Jay Harper part second, actually. You guys answer the question, advantage, disadvantage. I don't think it's a disadvantage, but fewer transfers. How do you guys feel about that?
I think it's a massive advantage. I think it helps preserve the culture that maybe is the number one thing that Marcus Freeman has instilled in Notre Dame, the unity, the brotherhood, that along with the ability to recruit and spend with anybody in the country. So I think it's a massive advantage. Like, yeah, you're still playing guys that haven't played, but they've been in your program for multiple years and kind of know what the reaction is going to be from the head coach on down when stuff gets thick.
Well, and I think another part of this too is just the retaining the players they typically want to keep. I mean, talked about Mookim, got him back. Other than Josh Burnham, I think the players they lost, they're all fine with too. So they're keeping the players they want to stick around and develop. And I agree with all the cultural stuff too. And generally, we've even heard from Mike Martin, it's a little cheaper to retain guys than it is to have to go out and compete for them in the portal too. So that maybe up to $50 million figure you talked about earlier, JB, might be even higher if they had to have more than eight or nine guys out of the portal every year.
You know, I think there's a happy medium here, and I think every year when we talk about what Notre Dame brought in through the transfer portal, it seems like the right number. It's you're not overdoing it because they don't have to. It's not an overhaul of the roster, and when you get into that 8-9 range, it seems to work really well for Notre Dame. I think we're hearing a lot of signs of Wisconsin struggling in certain areas in preseason camp. And some of it has to do with the number of people that they brought in. Now, look, they went 4-8. They scored 12.8 points per game last year. They had to bring people in. But I think, especially when you're talking about offensive line, and now they've had some injuries, it's difficult to develop a chemistry along an offensive line when you got a guy coming from this state over here and this state over here and this state over here, and you throw them all together and expect it to work. It generally doesn't work that way. So it works for Notre Dame, you know, as far as rating, I like what, 1 to 10, 1 to 5 rating rating them in the order that they're going to impact Notre Dame this year.
I think the one, just like if you would, how would you, what does he mean by?
Oh, I hadn't read that question yet.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. I was going to offer on the on the benefits and disadvantages. I think it's definitely a benefit for Notre Dame. You guys remember the one team that had fewer transfers than Notre Dame in 2024 that made the college football playoff?
Ohio State.
Exactly. They won the national title. Last year, though, I will say we were saying at this point Miami was in trouble because of early season trouble because of all their transfers. So it is your coaching staff's ability to get – I mean, they got Miami. Miami did a hell of a job with their transfers
they,
last
they
year.
Did, they
was,
did.
The concern was they wouldn't be ready. They did a great job. But
but even they still had a few game lull that almost cost them. If they didn't – might have not SMU. Made the playoffs if they didn't have that. They lost to Louisville too, right? And they – I mean, two teams they should not have lost to. Right. So they're – even they – dealt with it maybe just not off the bat.
You know, and they cut bait with Vaughn, the wide receiver from West Virginia that transferred in. They cut bait with him real early. And I think there might have, JB, I don't know, I think there might have been another transfer that is not there now already is gone from the program.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. Vaughn one was the most notable. The second part of that question or how you grade them, had they gotten Nick Marsh, I would give them an A+. I'm not being a jerk or flip for a change. I just really think as it's played out, they were disjointed as the portal opened, but they found a way to navigate through it and really nailed some spots that they had to nail. And yeah, we talk about Francis Brew and we talk about Teon Gray, Mylon Graham, and then the two specialists I think are significant. And Porath just gives you an element, or should give you an element based on his preseason performance that you did not remotely have a year ago. So I give them a B+, and I would give them an A+ had they nailed down Nick Marsh and signed this exact same group.
Yeah, I was going to say the Nick Marsh thing too. I think that's the one. So I think they're thrilled with how it ended up working out at defensive tackle and even getting Mylon Graham. But I think with some of the injury concerns, which maybe they could have predicted with Quincy Porter, if they had gotten Nick Marsh, like how different would we be talking about this team right now if they had that in the boundary versus the open question we have now? I think we would be even, I know a lot of people are picking Notre Dame to win the national championship as is, but we would be saying other than maybe offensive line, there isn't like a real hole we should be worried about. And that's more of a depth thing with the line anyways.
Yeah. Despite O'Malley's mendacity about the wide receivers, I think that if they had Nick Marsh, he maybe could truly not write about the 6, 7, 8 receivers anymore this year.
Well, I'm only writing scout team receivers. That's my new goal.
With Porter, to use a Marcus Freeman phrase, delayed gratification, it's probably going to have to be delayed gratification with him. So we never did read the question. I jumped the gun. Jay Harper 3, give the staff truth serum. How would you rate the portal haul as of today? Rate it? I think Brew and Gray are going to be a tremendous help. Here's the difference from previous Notre Dame transfer classes. There are multiple years involved here. So, Porter, let's say Porter doesn't even play this year, just plays a bit role. There's still plenty of time for you to maximize his ability. Same way with Graham, same way with Brew, same way with Teon Gray. The sleeper here is Jaden Sanders. And Chris Ash wasn't ready to name, he was, as of yesterday, wasn't ready to name DJ McKinney over Sanders for the starting field spot. But Sanders, I liked his, that was a kid that he was not highly rated at Michigan and came in, ended up starting, I think before the end of September for a couple games, then they got healthy and he didn't do it again, but he did a really, really nice job. I think he's a really, really key player for them. And Porath hit his one field goal yesterday. Apparently he struggled a little bit on Friday, which would be the first time we've heard any indication of him struggling. So yesterday again, he calmly comes up and, very uncomplicated and very calm and drills a 30 yarder. I said 30 plus. Drew, was it right at 30 yards?
Yes. Right at 30.
I think he's going to be, you had a better view of it than I did, but their numbers, I think Notre Dame has done year by year has done a really nice job of filling in spots where they need it, but not overdoing it to the point where you frustrate the players already on the team and to the point where chemistry is difficult to attain. They don't, Kane Madden, they since then they haven't gone out and got offensive linemen, and you still may have to do that sometime. But getting chemistry along an offensive line when you have four transfers is really difficult to do, and Notre Dame avoids that.
All right, Ohio Gold has asked this question probably 11 times, but he says, for the 100th time, what is your predicted too deep? because it's the podcast, we're not going to give you a predicted 2-deep Ohio goal, but I'm going to indulge you and ask a couple of questions on a couple of positions. From our panelists, we've lost John Bryce to a, I think he's going to scout backup wide receivers for the Irish in 2027 in case some of these guys can go. All right, here we go, guys. An alternate. Tim Priester first, backup quarterback.
Well, it hasn't been determined. We don't talk about depth.
We're asked, what is your predicted?
We're going to predict. Okay.
it's all we do for the last 10 months.
Well, again, okay, right. That's what I'm saying.
Who's your predicted backup quarterback?
Teddy Girard, ultimately. Not necessarily right out of the gate, but Teddy Girard.
I think he means game one, but because the depth chart's coming out next week. But
I'm going to go with Noah Grubbs for week one.
I'm going to go with Noah Grubbs, too, because Teddy Girard was watching the reps, and CJ Carr let him take one of his reps yesterday. And that is the wisdom of watching quarterbacks for 6 minutes in a random practice. I'm just giving you
I will agree with you. I'm torn a little bit because of Hebert and in the program. He was gone for a few days. I'll agree with you and say Grubbs starts the season.
Field cornerback. Because that is the major. That's the major battle, really, right?
Yeah, I still think it. I think you're best served by going with McKinney, and then Sanders is your Swiss Army knife back there in the secondary. I think that works out. Look, Sanders was a backup coming to Notre Dame. McKinney's a 40 game player, and I don't know how many games started. I think you got to go McKinney starting and Sanders behind him.
Yeah, I agree, especially since Chris Ash said it doesn't necessarily matter who starts, they're both going to play. So I think it's easier just from a kind of locker room standpoint to have the six-year guy who started go out there first, whereas the guy who's also having to take some reps at nickel be the guy who comes off the bench.
I agree with you both, and I also think to add to this, since Ohio Gold wants a little bit more, I think Jaden Sanders might be the first corner off the bench at if something were to happen to Leonard Moore, twist an ankle for two plays, too. Well, not two plays, because Mark Zachary would run right in the game.
The other option would be Zachary. And I think right now, if it came down to it, the confidence would be greater for Sanders.
I agree. Plus, he's the body type, too. Zachary looks a little out of place in the boundary. I don't think Sanders does.
Going to dig a little deeper. Backup role here. He said too deep. We know the starting safeties and the third guy. Who is the fourth? Joey O'Brien or Ethan Long?
I think it's Ethan Long to start the season. I think it's Joey O'Brien at some point.
I think it's Joey O'Brien already. I think they're saying enough good things about him, and I really like the idea of seeing Luke Kalich and Joey O'Brien on the field at the same time.
You're going for height?
Yeah.
I might have gone with Priester until listening. I didn't ask Ash this. Somebody else did, thankfully. Listening to Ash say how Joey O'Brien's been coming along, and then when... this leads into my next one. When someone followed up and asked about, could you say the same thing about Dunham and Iwatade? He's like, no, you can't. He's not in the same realm as Joey O'Brien. That's why I think it might be O'Brien. But that is the toughest one. Here's the deal. They're going to list five guys there. There's going to be an or coming up for this press thing for sure.
Yep.
Right defensive end. You assume Keon Keeley's the backup at left defensive end, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I would have said Dunham before yesterday, and we'll say Logan Thomas now.
Yeah, I'm still curious if they're like third and long situation. Logan Thomas, it makes more sense, but I am still curious about his ability to hold up against the run, whereas I think Dunham, even though he's a lot younger, I could see having more potential. So I do think the or could make sense there. Like, I think in certain situations, it probably might still make more sense to have Dunham. Game on the line, you're still going to have the starters out there anyways, but I think there might be a little more variability there.
Easy way to do this for defensive tackle. There's six. Name the two guys that are not in the two deep technically. Miner, Hughes, and Sevilano.
Hughes and Sevilano.
Yeah.
And finally, this is a semantics. Assuming KVA is not 100% ready for Wisconsin, who are the starting linebackers in the Wisconsin game that go out and play football on the opening series? And thus probably play the most snaps.
If you watched practice every day, you'd probably say Bowen Snead. And I'm going to say Bowen and Osbury.
I'm going to say Bowen and Osbury as well.
So there we go. Old habits die hard, right? And that's, that was a part of your all underrated, the Bowen and Osbury, along with some, was it Irish from A2? I don't want to give credit to
it. Yeah, it was point like, you know, we were saying Osbury, and one of our subscribers said, well, what about Bowen? And I really think that that's, I don't know if it's because it's okay, he's a given, he's expected to be good or what, but I think Bowen's is underrated too. I think both those guys are underrated.
Also underrated is next week. Go ahead, Drew.
Oh yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's unfortunate that we forget about Osbury so much. I think I had to be corrected once on how much he started last year, but he's just a consistent guy who does everything well. Yeah, so it's hard to see that going away. Even if Jalen Snead has made a lot of strides, I still think he might have a little bit more of a niche role. But especially in game one, if KVA is not getting a ton of reps or they want to hold him back a little bit, Snead is a guy who can take on that role as well as Luke Talich for some of the stuff they'd ask him to do.
And KVA in 2 years has started a grand total of 4 games.
And he won't start the opener. So
we know that we know that doesn't matter a whole lot.
No, it does not. What does matter is next week is game week. Finally, the second longest off season since the 70s. You guys know what the longest off season was?
Did it have something to do with the World War II?
No, since the 70s. Yes.
Oh.
Long time to go with that one. Yeah.
Just about every Jerry Fowle season?
No, 2007 to 2008, because they somehow started on September 6th, and they also ended on November 24th against Stanford on the David Grimes catch for the team. You have to not play in a bowl game on those, but good call the Jerry Fowle seasons, because
he didn't play in a bowl game much.
Those didn't play a bowl game either.
But he did beat Doug Flutie in an ice storm.
Gary Godsey beat Drew Brees.
I had to be there to believe it.
It's your favorite bowl. What are you talking about? It's our second favorite bowl, right? There is no Independence Bowl, Liberty Bowl. That's the next story. Get the scout team receivers and the Independence Bowl story on the same podcast next week. We'll have an extra one.
I want to go back to Nashville. The problem is if you go back to Nashville, you didn't have a great year.
And the problem is you might not see the Notre Dame team there because they will decline to play in that bowl.
Yes.
We will not decline anything next week. All questions. Maybe we'll just have I might even take a wide receiver question next week. August 31st, we'll be back. It will be later in the day after Marcus Freeman's opening press conference. A real depth chart will be out for Wisconsin, although I wouldn't believe everything you see on it. For Drew Medtalk and Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated, I'm Tim O'Malley. Thanks for watching and listening, Irish Illustrated Insider.